So, many thanks, José Luis. And I feel a bit uncomfortable in being the chair at the same time the speaker. So perhaps this conflict of interest should be resolved by giving to you, José Luis, the role of a chair in this moment. And please note that I gave you 5 minutes more. Just so this first session was dedicated to the subjects of consent. And the subjects addressed in this paper are states, both as subjects of international law and representative of the people. Then we had international organizations. We had non-state public institutions. We had, rapidly, private NGOs. Perhaps there is a missing actor here, and it's the individual, I think. And now, it's why the individual is missing. I don't know, perhaps it's a sign of the time. We spent the last decade speaking about the individual, now perhaps we are moving to collectivity, the people. And I would say that would be also a nice move. But perhaps the real explanation is the one which has been given by Fernando Bordin. So the orthodoxy is that individuals do not have the capacity to make international law, which is, I think, a point on which we can all agree, but it's not the end of the story, probably. My impression is there is something more to be said, I hope so, also from a normative perspective about how the fact that individuals are nowadays bearer of rights and obligations under international law may have implications for international lawmaking. Just think about one problem. Let us assume that individuals have the right to obtain reparation in case of international crimes. And the state may conclude an agreement. Now, here we have a problem about how individuals may be or should be involved in the lawmaking process. And also, I would say there is another problem. Here we have the state qua representative of the individual. And the position of the state qua representative of the individual may conflict with the state qua representative of the people. Now, recently, the case between the Democratic Republic and Congo and Uganda on reparation. Now, how free is a state to dispose of money given to repair the victims? And one could say, well, here, only the victims should be, let's say, the one who should be, who should receive the money decided by the ICJ. On the other side, one could say, no, the state, qua representative of the people, should dispose of a margin of discretion of how to use this money. So I will leave it here. I think there is something to say about that, even if it has not been the object of presentation this morning. And I move immediately to the three presentations of this session, which, in my view, complemented each other very well, because Fernando Bordin addressed consent of international organizations as a criterion of validity of customary international law on treaty rules, while the focus of the other two presentations were more on the role of consent as a ground of legitimacy. So there was really the three presentations complemented each other very well. So let me start from the first, Fernando's presentation. So much has been said and written in recent times about the role of international organizations in the formation of general rules of international law. Peremptory rules of international law, customary international law, general principles of international law. And probably this is also a consequence of the fact that the International Law Commission is nowadays working or has recently worked on these three areas. And there is one aspect of the recent work of the ILC on these three topics, general principles, peremptory rules of international law, customary law, that strikes me is what I perceive as a state-centric vision of international lawmaking. For instance, when it comes to peremptory rules of international law, the international community is simply the international community of states without international organization. And Fernando was referring to conclusion number four of the work on the identification of customer international rules. Well, I have the impression that that provision only provides a limited role for international organization in the formation of customary rules. So in some context, international organization seems to have no role at all. In other, they have only a very limited context. Why? Well, this is a question I would like to ask to Fernando, because the impression I had, perhaps I'm wrong, is that Fernando was in agreement with this view of the International Law Commission, seems to regard this approach of the ILC as reasonable. And if I get it correctly, the impression I have is that in Fernando's presentation, everything can be justified by the fact that behind the international organizations, there are states. So why international organizations are bound by customary rules? Well, because otherwise states can circumvent their customary obligation. Why international organization may contribute to the formation of customary international law? Well, otherwise states will be prevented from, states, member states will be prevented from participating to the customary law formation process. And why not to exceed in the role to be given to international organizations? Well, because there is the risk of double counting the practice of states. So it's, everything is, let's say, focused on the role of members. So in the end, I have the impression you are presenting international organizations as exclusively creatures of states. And I wonder whether a different vision of international organization can be put forward. Now, you refer to the advisory opinion of 1980, and the starting point of the ICJ, of the ICJ was as a subject of international law. It is legal personality, the fact that they are subject of legal order that justifies the fact that they are bound. Now, one can interpret that sentence, but I think there is a lot to be said about this, in the sense that I personally found this rather convincing. If you are regarded as a subject of a legal order, you are a member of a political community, you are bound by the general rules of the political community, but also you can contribute. Obviously, principle of speciality will tell us that they only can only contribute to a limited extent, to the limited extent of the powers attributed to international organizations. But I don't see the reason to refer to role of member state to explain and eventually to delimit the role of international organizations in the formation of customary international law. And here, I would like rapidly to develop about what Fernando presented as an incoherency, perhaps, in the approach of the International Law Commission to the legal personality of international organizations. And I think I agree with you on that. So if we regard the work of International Law Commission on the law of treaties or responsibility of international organizations, the International Law Commission contributed to create a very strong position of international organization entirely separated from member states. So if an international organization commit a wrongful act, member state cannot be held responsible. If a treaty has been concluded by member state, these cannot be binding for the organization. There is a clear division. So the International Law Commission, I repeat, contributed to create to construe a very strong legal position, I would say a very thick legal personality. But then I found it extremely strange that when it comes to customer international law, well, they only contribute when you have exclusive competence. I don't know what does it mean, exclusive competence for international organization, except for a very specific concept elaborated by the European Court of Justice in a very specific legal order, the one of the European Union. And I really don't know how one can extend this to other international organizations. So I stop it here with a presentation of Fernando. And I now move to the other two presentations. So as I said, Monique Chemillé-Gendreau, Samantha Besson, and José Luis Martí address the role of consent as a ground of legitimacy in international lawmaking. And obviously, I approach your paper, let's say, trying to see, to making a comparison, and I think you have a number of elements in common. You share the idea that, in principle, state consent is a means for enhancing the democratic legitimacy of international law, and second, that the role of states as representative of the people and of state consent as an instrument for the acceptance of international law by people suffers from important shortcomings. So these are, I would say, the two points in common. But at the same time, there are some differences. Now, I leave it to you, perhaps, to establish a dialogue on this. But perhaps my comment to Monique Chemillier-Gendreau est, peut-être je peux passer au français. Je peux passer au français, c'est difficile à dire pour moi, parce que j'ai toujours l'impression de parler une seule langue, c'est la langue italienne, mais en tout cas, je vais essayer de parler un peu de français maintenant. Donc, il me semble que la critique que vous portez au rôle de l'État est beaucoup plus radicale que la critique portée par Samantha et José Luis. Et José Luis et Samantha ils défendent aussi le rôle de l'État. Alors que je n'ai pas vu une défense du rôle de l'État dans votre présentation. Donc, vous soulignez que la volonté de chaque État représente souvent seulement celle des représentants du pouvoir. Vous dites clairement que le consentement de l'État, le consentement ne peut pas être réduit à celui de l'État. Et je voudrais alors savoir quel est ou quel devrait être le rôle de l'État dans les contextes du cosmopolitisme souple dont vous avez parlé. Donc, faut-il préserver un certain rôle de l'État? Faut-il aller plus loin de ça? Et ma deuxième question concerne les pluralismes de la société internationale. Vous parlez du risque que la volonté générale puisse devenir un masque pour la domination. Et donc, vous êtes contraire à l'idée d'un gouvernement mondial qui, je vous cite, serait une nouvelle forme de domination. Et donc, cela pose les problèmes que vous avez évoqués à la fin de votre intervention. Comment réformer les institutions mondiales? Des formes accrues de participation de la société civile pourraient être suffisantes? Vous avez mentionné la perspective d'un nouvel agencement des communautés politiques entre elles et à divers échelons territoriaux. Et à quoi vous faites référence? Est-ce que, aujourd'hui, par exemple, on insiste beaucoup sur le fait que le multilatéralisme doit être à plusieurs niveaux, avec un rôle fondamental du régionalisme? Est-ce que vous faites mention du régionalisme dans votre travail? Donc l'idée que la gouvernance mondiale doit être plus proche des personnes en établissant des mécanismes de désorganisation régionale, sub-régionale et tout ça. And I move again to Italian English. I have mainly two questions to your very rich paper. So, José Martín was saying nobody will complain. Well, as a commentator, I complain, but it doesn't matter. My first question concerns the importance to be attached to the question of the democratic legitimacy of international law. I definitely agree with your point of view about the importance of the role of the state in the treaty-making process, and I would say particularly within international institutions. But I wonder whether it makes sense at all to speak of democratic legitimacy when it comes to other sources of international law, like international custom. You mention it in your paper, not in your presentation today. But the risk I see when one stresses the role of consent, for instance, in the customary lawmaking process, is to place too much emphasis, also from a normative perspective, on the importance of state consent in the process of the formation of customs. For instance, you stress a lot the importance of the persistent objector rule, saying, well, it has a sort of democratic value. Now, I must confess that I'm not very fond of a persistent objector rule, and I fail to see the virtue of the persistent objector rule, also from a democratic perspective. Now, you frequently say that consent is a way to avoid the domination by the powerful over the weak states. I would say that persistent objector has the opposite aim. I mean, if I read Chimney, and I agree entirely with Chimney on this, I would agree that the persistent objector has mainly been invented by powerful states to escape from a majoritarian lawmaking process within the international community. I just mentioned that the last time I heard speaking about the persistent objector rule was in the Chagos Archipelago case. It was invoked by United Kingdom to say that the principle of self-determination was not applicable in that case for a number of reasons. And then I have a last remark. Again, you develop these a lot in your paper, not very much today, but I was very much intrigued by this concept of multiple sovereignty. So the idea is the state is not the only sovereign. Non-state public institutions should also be regarded as sovereign. My question is, and perhaps more than a question, it is a request for clarification, is what one has to gain from recognizing that non-state public institutions have partial sovereignty. So what are the implications of that? Let me try to explain my doubts about this. It is true that in international legal thinking, the dominant view is the perception of a state as a unitary subject. However, international law takes into account the fact that behind the monolithic face of a state, there are many, a plurality of state organs, and that these organs may speak on behalf of the state, and sometimes with different voices. Now, for instance, this is clear when it comes to customary lawmaking. I mean, the practice of a member state of a federation can count as state practice, so contribute to the formation of international law. But I would say it's also true when it comes to treaty making, when treaty making power is concerned. Let's say, under international law, as far as I regard things, treaty making belongs to the state. Then how this treaty making is exercised by the state, well, this belongs to the state to decide. It's an internal decision. It's the way in which the state internally organizes its distribution of power. Now, and this obviously allows the state to confer treaty-making power to cities eventually, or to regions, or to member states of a federation. Now, in 1966, the draft articles on the law of treaties contained a provision who said state members of a federal union may possess the capacity to conclude treaties. But it is the second part of that provision which is, I think, it's very useful in order to obtain some clarification about the meaning of sovereignty in this context. Because the provision says also that capacity of state members of a federal union exists only if admitted by the federal constitution and within the limits laid down by the constitution. So here comes my question. So by saying that non-state public institutions should be recognized as sovereign, are you implying that their power to conclude an agreement comes from international law, not from domestic law? And now, if this is true, how can you limit this power to make an agreement by a member state of a federation? And how can you coordinate the power of a state and the power of a city and the power of... Now, you make a parallel with the European Union, but there is a way of coordinating. You have the European Court of Justice establishing all the different... who is competent in this area, who is not. In an international law system, is it possible to imagine a sovereign city having a treaty-making power based on international law without substantial limitations, if I understand well? These are a risk for the fragmentation of international society. And I stop it here.